The Guardian.
The joy of ebooks is that great stories are just a click away. For our podcast listeners, we have a great offer on Luke Harding's book Mafia State, a menacing tale of life as a journalist in present-day Russia. I'll tell you more at the end of the show.
Hello, this is Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. On the show this week...
Mr. Maloney, will you demonstrate your displeasure? Thank you.
Yes, it's that time of year again when the Ig Nobel Prizes celebrate great scientists doing seemingly ridiculous research. We'll be talking to a UK winner about that particular sense of pride and embarrassment that every scientist must feel on receiving the award. And
it's just something I remember hearing in a lecture about animals that have the ability to reproduce without males, and that there's actually a huge variety of ways in which they do it. It's not a one-size-fits-all.
And Alok Jha meets science writer Arati Prasad to talk the biology of virgin births. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. I'm joined by The Observer's science editor, Robin McKee, to discuss some of the science stories of the week. Robin, good to see you.
Good to see you.
First up, Robin, more water on Mars.
Yes, well, we've got everything else but water, I think. This is Curiosity doing its first bit of interesting results. It's trundled a few tens of metres, found what looks quite like an old stream bed, with some pebbles there that could have been bashed about in water millions and millions of years ago. So it's kind of all the evidence is adding up, I suppose.
I was looking into some of this, and I think some of the earliest evidence that came back to Earth about there being previously water on Mars, and we're talking about ancient water on Mars, came from Mariner 9 in like 1971, 1972, and it turned up amid this crazy storm that engulfed the whole planet. And then when the sort of dust settled, you could see these riverbeds carving out, you know, on the landscape. And now we are here with, it seems a year doesn't go by without some new evidence for water on Mars. What I liked about the Curiosity stuff was it showing that these were sort of golf ball sized round pebbles and then some more sort of angular flakes that showed evidence that they've been transported quite a long way and by the size and so on. So you have this sort of these pebbles and fragments strewn across the landscape showing you where the water had gone. And they reckon that that river went at about a meter a second. So pretty charging along and about somewhere between ankle and waist deep. So quite a nice sounding river, really.
It sounds quite a good place to go fishing, isn't it?
Yeah. What they've not been able to do yet is date it. So we don't know whether this was around sort of 2 billion years ago, 1 billion years ago, or sometime far more recent than that.
But if it's more recent than that, then it gets really interesting. If it's 2 billion years ago, well, we kind of knew that, didn't we?
Yeah. And I think as John Grotzinger, the principal scientist on the expedition, was saying, it's not really our prime habitat we're looking for, because they're looking for areas where life may have survived on Mars. He's saying it's not really the prime place, a flowing river, but they're still going to crack on and get onto these sort of gentle slopes of that huge mountain in the middle of the Gale crater and look for more evidence that it was once habitable there. So I think the big stuff is still to come.
Yes. Yeah, well, we've got a couple of great years ahead of us from Curiosity. It's going to be a great ride.
Robin, another story you've been looking at this week is the fate of the British Antarctic Survey. What's going on there?
Yes. Well, I mean, it's a rather worrying one, I think. Natural Environment Research Council, like so much of the government organisations, has to take a fairly major hit from the coalition government. Dave Willetts wants its budgets down 10%, I think it is, in expenditure and capital budget, way down, like something like 40% by 2015. And one plan that looks almost dead set to happen is to close down the British Antarctic Survey in Cambridge, move it to Southampton, where we have the National Oceanographic Centre, and create a Centre for Marine and Polar Science. And not surprisingly, this has appalled many people, politicians, campaigners, and scientists. The British Antarctic Survey has a tremendous reputation, lean, efficient, some of the best polar scientists in the world. It was our scientists, the working out there, that discovered the hole in the ozone layer, for example. And this work is being they say, undermined. To be fair to the National Environment Research Council, they say it's a natural merging of talents. Marine and polar sciences go together, and they'll be much more efficient. You take what you will about that. I think they would say that. And it's certainly, you can hear the screams of horror from right across the board about this one.
Is it too early to talk about numbers? Do we know how many people are likely to not be in the British Antarctic Survey after the merger?
No, I don't. No numbers have been given. But what the great fear is that the previous director and his deputy have already gone, and the fear that I could detect from the scientists that I spoke to is the fact that all the good scientists they've got there now are not going to hang around. They're just going to take it and walk. And a great deal of British expertise will be dissipated at a time when we need it most, because what's happening at the poles in terms of climate change is absolutely fundamental. Now, we've got a very good... It's happened abruptly in the Arctic, the changes there. The Antarctic's a very different beast. It's a high continent. It's not warming up at its heart as much as it is the way it is at the Arctic. However, the Antarctic Peninsula is warming. And it is, you know, and it is melting. And what's happening there is very worrying. It's somebody to liken it as the awakening giant, you know, of climate change. And that's what's happening in the Antarctic. We need to be there. We need to understand this fundamentally. And to close down or merge the senior scientific organisation in charge of that, well, it seems like lunacy to many people.
Is there anything the scientists are doing to try and, you know, fight their case to take this to higher powers? And
well, there's a parliamentary group, or polar parliamentary all-party group, and they've pledged to sort of take this to Willits and to government and fight it, because for the reasons that I've outlined.
There was some good news last week, though. The complete works of Alfred Russel Wallace went online for the first time ever. And now this was a fantastic years-long project to gather together all the books and letters and articles written by Wallace, who was the contemporary of Charles Darwin, who came up with the theory of evolution via natural selection around the same time. The two men's papers were read on the same day at the Linnaean Society in London. And Wallace is often overlooked for the work he did. And in that collection, I mean, it's fascinating. He spent 8 years in Southeast Asia, yomping around the Malay archipelago. And he was there essentially as a poor man, a self-styled British naturalist, collecting samples to ship back to London to sell for a profit. But in doing that, he found, as Darwin did, that there were just these similarities between species and so on that eventually got him to this point of coming up with evolution, and also in the fit of a malarial fever, hitting on this idea of natural selection, where there are many that are born, some die, few survive, and this whole very harsh but romantic story. He was one of those few scientists in history who genuinely seemed to have a eureka moment almost from his deathbed. And unlike Darwin, he was a fantastic artist. You look at some of Darwin's pictures and they're shockingly bad. They're the sorts of things you could do yourself. And there's like a little stick man in his notebooks and things. Look at Wallace's work. He was a very, very accomplished painter. He did watercolours, he did sketches, intricate ones of people as well, and faces and perspectives and so on. He talked very elaborately, perhaps, about some of his adventures around the archipelago. And he would talk about, you know, the fear of tigers coming upon you and so on, and eating durian fruit, which was this coconut-sized fruit that was a delicacy, but also so pungent and so horrific smelling that often it would clear a house out if you brought one of these things home. But he develops a taste for it, and he has these reflections in his letters where he's saying, you know what, actually this stuff is exquisite. And he describes it in the most toe-curling way, and it's just sort of a cream cheesy taste with sort of boiled onions and all this other thing, which you read it and you think this sounds absolutely revolting, but he says when you eat it, it's as if it needs nothing more. It's just this perfect thing once you get used to it. It just shows the extraordinary sort of ability of the man to adapt, I think, as he was going around that region.
I'm just going to say, I'm glad you brought that one up, because I think he's a great man, an absolute hero of mine. And, you know, he was a champion of women's rights. He was an early socialist. Lots of the things he believed in were ahead of his time. He did have his weak moments. He believed in spiritualism, whereas Darwin did not. But, I mean, hell, nobody's perfect. And I remember reading one of his books, and he goes to the East Indies and he sees all these wonderful orangutans, and he thinks sees a beautiful specimen. So I took out my gun and shot it. To 21st century eyes, it makes you wince, but I wouldn't want to detract from an absolutely superb guy who didn't have the money that Darwin had, but still, you know, did the business.
Something I thought was extraordinary from reading some of the pieces he wrote was that he turned up in Singapore in 1854 and very quickly sees and comments on what farming is doing to the habitats he's trying to survey. And he comes out with some of the earliest calls for conservation. And there's one point where he talks about the species he's trying to document as being the letters of history, and that as they get obliterated by the land being taken back for farming, you lose those letters, the sentences become unintelligible, and you lose this stuff. It's obliterated forever. And he says this wonderful quote. He says, "Future ages." He says, if we can't stop this happening, he says, future ages will certainly look back upon us as a people so immersed in the pursuit of wealth as to be blind to higher considerations. And this was in before 1900s. And you think this was, you know, more than 100 years ago, just saying the habitat is disappearing before our eyes. We cannot document it quick enough. Extraordinary stuff.
Yeah.
If you want to have a look at some of Wallace's writings and some of his artwork, we will put a link to that online resource at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.
Good evening. We are gathered here tonight to honor some remarkable individuals and groups. Each winner has done something that first makes people laugh and then makes them think.
The Ig Nobel Awards might have started out as an attempt to show that the science community can laugh at itself and proved its point. But now it's become an established part of the science calendar, and in a strange way is a fitting run-in to the Nobel Prize on the 8th of October. We'll know then if we have a British Nobel winner, but for sure we know now that we have a UK Ig Nobel winner. I'm joined on the line by Professor Robin Ball. Congratulations, Robin. This comes as a surprise to you.
It certainly did, although one of my co-authors commented that he thought that when we put the Rapunzel number in the paper, it was always likely.
Just give our listeners a quick outline of the work you've done. I know it as the equation for the ponytail, but we need to know more than that. What have you done?
What we really set out to do was to understand the forces that give hair bulk or body. Now, I think it's clear to most people that's because hair isn't totally straight, it's curly, it's wavy, and that means it bulks out. But the question was whether we could build a physics-based mathematical model of that and confirm it was right. Initially, we had the model and old experiments not really confirming it, and the key breakthrough was when my two colleagues in this, Patrick Warren at Unilever and Ray Goldstein from Cambridge, collaborated to actually measure the shape of these ponytails. It's just a very direct measurement that you can make on the experimental samples available, which is puts the force of gravity in competition with these bulk forces of the hair, and I think we can model gravity fairly well if we've got the bulk forces of the internal pressure of the hair right. Then we should be able to predict the shape at which they come into balance, and that's what was indeed shown to work rather well. That then led to the paper and the the Ig Nobel Prize for our pains.
Where did you get all your ponytails from? Did you go to a computer science conference?
No, we didn't. Unilever were a key player in this research. They're a major supplier and developer of hair care products. They, like others in the industry, buy in sample hair switches, which are basically a little ponytail. I think the standard length is 10 inches. So they have a great many of these samples available. And what's really nice about them, actually, is that the hair from many different people is mixed in order to generate a fairly reproducible ponytail sample. So, of course, the idea then is you can treat one way and another a different way and compare the results.
Tell me about the Rapunzel number.
The Rapunzel, right. There's a characteristic length in the problem, which is how long does a piece of hair need to be before it will significantly bend under gravity? The Rapunzel number is how long compared to that length is a strand of hair. So a Rapunzel number bigger than one means if you were to hold a piece of hair sideways, gravity will really thoroughly bend it over. A Rapunzel number less than one, gravity has only a minor effect on, and the hair would just poke out as straight as it wanted to be.
You're bringing back to me, Robin, these lessons on Young's modulus I used to have at school.
Oh yes, Young's modulus enters the bendability of a beam, and for the bendability of the hair, we're using the very same beam bending formula that, for example, civil engineers use for concrete beams. And indeed, it involves Young's modulus and the fourth moment of radius.
Tell me about the ceremony. Did you make it out there?
Yes, it was a pleasure. In fact, all three of us and a co-recipient from a different piece of work from Stanford, Joe Keller, we all went there. This whole thing is really quite tongue-in-cheek, but what's precious about it is that it's very much a celebration of the fun that in research. It's a tremendously effective way of reaching out to the public and indeed to the press, who are the route to really large-scale outreach.
I'm here with Robin McKee on The Observer. Robin, you had a question.
Yeah, it's going to change your life, Robin, you know.
Come is on, it going to change my life?
Come on, be honest. You know, is it Wine, Women and Song from No, No? Spend.
No, certainly not. No. My colleagues have all been remarkably positive about it. There's an element of living it down. It certainly inspire us to push the hair research forward further. You know, we've seen a very big return in terms of exposure from it. I hope that all the publicity has inspired other people to get involved in real-world problems that maybe sound a bit quirky, but which are accessible to analysis and where some real quantitative modelling and understanding can have an impact and get across just how much fun research can be.
Thanks, Robin. That's brilliant. Arathi Prasad is a scientist and science writer working in the area of cell cycle biology and mammalian reproduction. Her recent book is titled Like a Virgin, How Science is Redesigning the Rules of Sex. It sets out to survey research into reproduction and, as the title alludes, ask the provocative question, are we moving into a post-sexual reproduction era in humankind? And if so, what are the advantages and disadvantages? Alok Jha met Arathi Prasad and started out by asking her what drew her to reproduction without sex, the so-called virgin births.
When I was an undergraduate, I was studying developmental biology, and my first research project was in male infertility. And I always found that process fascinating of how egg and sperm become a new organism and all the pitfalls that can happen on the way. And it's just something I remember hearing in a lecture about animals that have the ability to reproduce without males, and that there's actually a huge variety of ways in which they do it. It's not a one-size-fits-all solution or mechanism. And just that huge variety and the fact that humans couldn't do it, I found interesting. Because people said to me, well, we can't do it, so why are you writing about it? And I said, well, it's the fact that we can't.
Which animals do it? I mean, which complex animals would you find surprising, the fact that they can actually reproduce without males?
One that's talked about a lot is the whip-tail lizard, but this is a really fascinating animal. They're called sort of the lesbian lizards for the reason that... So the whip-tail lizard originated when... two lizards of a related species mated, so a male from one species and a female from another. And in the offspring that they had, a female, there was a mutation, and that mutation meant that this female could then go on to reproduce without males. And in this species of whip-tail lizard, there are no males. But when they reproduce, they enact a mating ritual, as it were, exactly that you'd see in a male and female from a related species, where one female mounts the other female. So you could say one female is acting out or looks like what the male from another species would be doing. So she mounts the other female and bites her neck and displays those sort of aggressive parts of the ritual. And then she lifts the passive female, or the female's tail up, and rubs their cloacas together. And that in males usually would cause the male's penis to erect, one of two penises. They're very strange animals. They also walk on water. But what happens is really interesting. If you then dissect them after this mating, is what you see is in the female that acted like the male, the more aggressive one, the eggs are small and immature and nothing particular is happening. But in the female who acted out the female's role, as it were, her eggs are ready to go. So something in that act, and we don't know what it is, but something in that act causes the eggs to have a signal to say, right, I'm going to start developing into an embryo.
So this female whip-tail lizard can essentially have... can lay eggs without being fertilized by anything else, but requires this ritual to do it. Yeah. Now that's interesting, but in a sense, do we know how genetically diverse those animals are? I mean, are they very similar? Are they clones? In what way, you know, does that species continue?
Parthenogenesis is the technical term for virgin birth, and there are many kinds of parthenogenesis. So, for example, there's another one called kleptogenesis, where females borrow or steal sperm, and they use the sperm to trigger the eggs, but the genetic material from the father is never integrated. So there are many mechanisms that are used to trigger the eggs to develop, but these are not clones, for the reason that when a woman's eggs produce, there's a shuffling of DNA in a process called meiosis. And during that process, the DNA is shuffled so that no two eggs will really be exactly the same. And that's why two siblings can look very different, even though they're from, well, the same parents, but from the same gametes, the same eggs and sperm from the same parents. So there is inherently in the generation of gametes already some diversity. You'll never have any more genetic information than your parent had.
But other than the odd spot random mutation.
Yeah, but yeah, exactly. But it won't, you won't be exactly, you won't look exactly the same. And then if you look at turkeys and Komodo dragons, they actually have sons through virgin births and sons and daughters through sex. So the sons clearly are not clones of their mother. And that's because of their way their chromosomes are shuffled. We females, humans, have two X chromosomes, so two of the same chromosomes, but that's what happens in male Komodo dragons. They have two of the same chromosomes. So, yeah, they're not the same. They're not exactly genetically the same. So some diversity is introduced. And the other thing that's interesting genetically is this phenomenon known as genetic purging. So when you have animals that inbreed very closely, and you also see this in human communities that marry very closely with closely related relatives, or you don't have to go too far back to find that someone was related in the family. All of the mutations or the genes that are harmful and deleterious that are going to cause proper problems die out in the population. So what you have are you're passing on close related DNA that isn't actually so bad for you. When the Komodo dragons have sons by virgin births, anyone that has something too dangerous dies out, and so the ones that are left aren't carrying this. So that's called genetic purging. So there are different ways in which variability and health is installed in this process.
What's the advantage of doing this? Why do any animals do it at all, given the obvious advantages of mixing two different genetic clumps of animals? Why would any species find it advantageous to do this?
Well, that's what I find interesting. In the bigger animals that were only recently found out about, like Komodo dragons and two or three species of sharks now, is these animals are endangered and kept in zoos, so they're on known breeding programs. And what happens in breeding programs is females are kept on their own in zoos. So sharks were kept in a tank with all females, Komodos. There were only two female Komodos in Europe, one in London, one in Chester. And when the breeders wanted to mate them, they'd bring in a known male from a stud book. And I think this is part of the reason why. What they found is if females were with males, they'd mate. But if they weren't with males, they'd go ahead and have young anyway. So I kind of think about it as a choice between breeding with less diversity or not breeding at all. And I guess it's favorable for them to continue breeding rather than their species dying out, for example.
So the $64 million question about this is, you know, whether it's possible in people or not. Of course, every culture has a myth of some virgin birth. Most famous, of course, being Jesus Christ. These stories must have gone back over a long period of time. These things have existed before we knew about parthenogenesis and genetics. These stories have existed. What do you think fascinates us about them? And is it possible in people in any even theoretical way?
Originally, if you go back to Bronze Age cultures, to the first imagery of people and of deities, it was women who were worshipped as gods, as givers of life. And for many years, for millennia, you see, dissection wasn't allowed on humans, so no one really studied the female anatomy very well. So you can imagine, you know, people looking at a woman growing larger and giving birth to a new human. How strange was that? I mean, how can you explain that? So I think it was clear that out of women, children emerged. But then came the ideas from Aristotle and Galen that were very, very long-lived and entered medical textbooks until frighteningly recently, 19th century, where that women were just vessels that carried the children. The actual inheritance came solely from the father. So there's this kind of dissonance in what people saw around them and what was actually happening, but they couldn't explain, and they were trying to find ways to explain it. But I think the stories of virgin births also were attached to anyone who was considered to be a great human being. So Genghis Khan, Alexander the Great, in retrospect, all of these people were considered to have come from virgin mothers. And you could argue that if it was a divine intervention, that mostly men were gods, and therefore if women did get pregnant, they were still getting pregnant through the divine intervention of God. But you could also step on things or eat things or touch things, or, you know, there are many ways.
It's a dangerous world out there.
It's a danger. Yeah, if you are seeking not to have children, yeah, it could happen at any time. No, but until 1984, no one knew that there was a genetic mechanism in humans and most mammals. I say most mammals because there is the duck-billed platypus, who are extremely secretive animals and do lay eggs. They're the only mammal that does. So who knows? I'd like to know. But in 1984, they discovered a genetic mechanism called imprinting, which means that some genes they're all there and they're working, but they're unable to be read. So what you have is an instruction book. Say you had two copies of the same book, the instruction book from mother and the father. In one, page 9 is unreadable, and the other, page 9 is readable, etc. So to have the whole narrative arc, you're going to need two copies of the book. And that those locks on the genes are reversible, so you can put them on and take them off. And during the production of sperm and eggs, they are put on and taken off. And that means that absolutely naturally, no human or mammal that we know of can go ahead and have babies on their own. We try. I mean, human eggs and mammalian eggs, in almost every mammalian species, we've found things called teratomas, which is when eggs start dividing on their own. So there are many cues that can make an egg start developing. And these eggs start developing. And remember that everything comes out of the egg, because the sperm delivers a packet of DNA, but the egg has everything in it that needs to build the layers of a new body. And so in these teratomas, these monstrous tumors, you have layers of skin and hair and teeth, and you even get eyes and all sorts. So it looks like an amalgamation of spare body parts, a lump of... It's quite frightening looking. That will never go on to become a baby, because the genes that are locked in the female but come from the male's genome encode the placenta. And without a placenta, the pregnancy can't go to term. So no, absolutely not in humans. But it hasn't stopped people imagining it. But as I say, it wasn't until relatively recently. Like in 1955, for example, there was a nationwide hunt for a virgin mother, which came from a lecture by a scientist at University College London, and then launched a tabloid search. And 11 women came forward. And it wasn't so implausible at that time to think, because they were just discovering that a lot of animals were doing it, and there was no reason to suppose that humans couldn't. And people were even breeding animals. So there were a type of turkey called Beltsville turkeys. There was an idea in... proposed by scientists in Edinburgh, that in farms, why should you waste all your resources on raising large males when all you actually want from them is a little sperm? So let's try and generate lines of females that can generate, that can reproduce without men, males.
Now, a lot of that points towards the sort of future of reproduction. We've learned so much about genetics, and we can manipulate cell division in the lab now. And a lot of that has been used, of course, to help infertile couples, IVF being a classic example. But in the future, do you see more interference with reproduction beyond IVF, beyond helping couples have children? I mean, could you imagine two eggs being fused together from different women, or two eggs from one woman to create a baby? Or you can also create sperm now from skin cells by making them into stem cells and then making them divide into, and you can do all of this stuff theoretically. In the future, it's going to get better and better. Is that a direction you think that people are going to go in? I mean, the idea of virgin births in that case is the beginning of saying that, you know, an individual can easily create another human being if you just do all this manipulation without the need for another human being.
You were asking about sex earlier and its place in evolution, why it's so long lived, and sex benefits populations. It's not out to benefit an individual, but I think we are a population of individuals, aren't we? Increasingly in the lives we live. And people want children, and so yes, I think if the technology is out there, theoretically, yes, I think people will start using it in weird and wonderful ways.
Arati, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Arati Prasad's Like a Virgin, How Science is Redesigning the Rules of Sex is published by One World and available in all good bookshops now. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Ian Sample, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For a limited period only, we have an exclusive ebook offer for Guardian podcast listeners. Guardian columnist Luke Harding's Mafia State is a dark and ominous insight into the life of a journalist in present-day Russia. We're offering 30% off the list price of $4.99. All you have to do is go to the ebook store www.kobo.com, that's kobo.com, and at checkout put in the discount code Mafia State for your Guardian podcast offer.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.